Hello, this is Chris Attig, and I'm the host of the VA Form 21 podcast. Today, we are going to bring to you oral arguments in the case of Seller v. Wilkie, and we're going to talk about the role intent plays in the filing of an informal claim. Or, in layman's terms, would you please just get your chocolate bar out of my darned peanut butter? Before we get to that, though, let's get a little business out of the way. The VA Form 21 podcast is a production of the law firm of Attig Steele. Attig Steele provides caring, effective, and efficient representation to veterans battling the VA for benefits in the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. You can learn more about me and the law firm of Attig Steele at our website, attigsteele.com. The VA Form 21 podcast is going to provide several different types of episodes to you. Now, you can hear in episodes 1 through 6, we've been hosting recordings of oral arguments and appeals before the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. And beginning with episode 4, I started providing you a synopsis of the case to better prepare you for the arguments that you are about to hear. In other episodes, like episode 7, I'm going to share with you practical advocacy skills, tools that will help you to become a better advocate for your veteran clients. And in future episodes, we are going to talk about the business of being a veteran's lawyer. If your business as a veteran's lawyer is not profitable, you can't help veterans. Now, I've learned some very hard lessons about how to make a small or solo law firm profitable in the veterans law practice area, and I'm going to share what I've learned with you so you don't have to make the same mistakes that I did. If you've got suggestions about topics that you'd like to hear about on this podcast, please feel free to email me at vetlaw@attigsteele.com. If you are getting value from this podcast, and I sure hope you are, or if you just want to support its continued availability, please click on the links in the show notes and become a sponsor of the VA Form 21 podcast over at patreon.com/VAForm21. As a rookie sponsor, I'm going to give you sponsors-only episodes of the podcast once a month, and I'll start sending you copies of forms and templates that I use in my veterans law practice every single day. Now, becoming a sponsor is completely optional. I'm still going to love you, and I'm still going to share all this wonderful information with you if you don't become a sponsor, but becoming a sponsor, it just makes you feel good about yourself. So why not do that, right? All right, now that the business is out of the way, let us jump into oral arguments in the case of Sellers v. Wilkie, cause number 16-3992. The oral arguments were held on May 1st, 2008. First, I'm going to give you a general overview of the law related to informal claims, specifically reasonably encompassed claims. Then we are going to dive into the facts of the case and the BVA decision as is relevant to the appeal and specifically relevant to the oral arguments. I'm going to share with you the veterans' argument from their briefs and the secretary's argument from their briefs, and then going to quote for you the court's statement of the issue. Now, I've also got a couple notes regarding this argument. Some of the things that you're going to hear are going to be very interesting. And once we wrap all that up, I will introduce you to the voices you're going to hear on this recording. I'm going to tell you who's on your panel. I'm going to tell you who your appellant counsel is, the VA Office of General Counsel Attorney, and then I'm going to tell you where you can find links to all of the parties' briefs and the BVA decision in this case. So, let's jump in and get an overview of the law related to informal claims, specifically what are called reasonably encompassed claims. So the law governing VA claims has always allowed for veterans to file claims formally or informally, and different regulatory provisions are going to address those requirements throughout time. The distinction between a formal and an informal claim is often one that, in my personal opinion, has only hyper-technical consequences. Regardless whether a claim is filed informally or whether it's filed formally, its elements remain the same. The court has long held that the essential requirements of any claim, whether it's formal or informal, include, first, you've got to have an intent to apply for benefits. Second, you've got to identify the benefits sought. And third, you've got to have a communication in writing. And those core elements are only about 9 years old, come from a case called Brokowski, and the cite to that is in the show notes. Next, in determining whether a formal or even an informal claim for, let's call it condition X, reasonably encompasses a claim for condition Y, the secretary has a duty to sympathetically read a pro se veteran's filings to determine whether a claim for benefits has been raised at all. And that's a case I am going to butcher the name of, and you're going to have to correct me on it, so I'm going to spell it for you, but it's Semraj, S-Z-E-M-R-A-J. And the cite to that is in the show notes. It is a Fed Circa 2004 case. Also, we know that the VA is required to read and construe all communications from a pro se vet in a sympathetic manner and grant all possible benefits. So, in determining whether a claim, whether it's formal or informal, reasonably encompassed a particular condition, there's two elements that are really critical, and those are intent and scope. Now, I'm going to take a pause here, and I'm going to talk to you about an author's note here, go on a little sidebar. The issue of intent in an informal or a formal claim, but primarily in the context of a reasonably encompassed claim, is a question largely unanswered at the court. The secretary always tends to argue that specific intent for a specific benefit for a specific condition is necessary, and I won't address the fundamental flaws in that position. The appellants, not just in this case but in other cases, tend to argue that the sympathetic reading standard should apply to that intent element, but that intent is generally thought to be an intent to claim benefits generally, not benefits for a specific functional impairment or a specific diagnosis. This flashpoint of controversy was where I thought the court was headed in its statement of issues for oral argument, and I'm just not so sure anymore after listening to it. That said, a veteran's intent in filing a claim is critical to construing the scope of a VA claim because, as said in the Clemens case, it is the pro se claimant who knows what symptoms he is experiencing that are causing him disability. As to the scope of the claim, the words written or not written on a claim form are going to be probative of the scope of a claim. The nature of the affliction experienced by a claimant is going to be of greater significance to the scope of the claim. In fact, in the Delisio case, a claimant, quote, sufficiently files a claim for benefits by referring to a body part or system that is disabled or by describing symptoms of the disability, close quote. And Delisio is a 2011 case out of the Court of Veterans Appeals. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, I'm sorry. In determining whether an open claim reasonably encompassed the condition that caused a specifically claimed condition, the court's going to explain that the scope of the VA claim for benefits which identifies a specific diagnosis is not limited necessarily to benefits for that diagnosis. Even where a veteran specifically identifies, let's say, PTSD without more in his claim, the veteran is going to be construed to file a claim for the affliction, his mental condition, whatever that causes him. That's Clemens and the Delisio cases read together. So in determining whether a disability reasonably encompasses another condition, or a claim for condition X reasonably encompasses a claim for condition Y, the BVA has got to consider the conditions that the veteran states and the causes that are averred in the record to determine whether a claim is reasonably raised. And that's the Ingram case from 2007. The BVA has got to investigate reasonably apparent and potential causes of a claimed condition and theories of service connection reasonably raised by the record or a sympathetic reading of the claim. And that's the Schroeder case from the Fed Circuit in 2000. So, in a nutshell, most appellants are going to talk about this sympathetic assessment of the scope of VA claim. And it's based on the claimant's description of the claim, the symptoms the claimant describes, the information the claimant submits, or even the information that the secretary obtains in support of a claim, including information gathered by the VA in its developmental investigations. And you can look to the Clemens case for a lot of explanation and discussion about the sympathetic assessment of the scope of VA claim. But to be clear, this sympathetic assessment of the scope of a VA claim has got to have limits. On one end of the spectrum, the BVA does not have to go on what Brokowski calls an unguided safari through the record to identify all conditions for which the vet may be possibly able to assert entitlement to a claim for disability compensation. But at the other end of the spectrum, the veteran is not required to file explicit claims for specific diseases or specific diagnoses, since that's going to be an over-technical and generally incompatible process, at least in terms of what is called the veteran-friendly non-adversarial administrative claim system. And you can look to Delisio for that end of the spectrum. Between those two ends lies the critical work of the board in deciding material issues of fact, such as the effective date for a particular grant of service connection. The board has to provide adequate reasons and bases. That includes analyzing the credibility and probative value of the evidence, accounting for evidence it finds persuasive or unpersuasive, and providing reasons for its rejection of any material evidence favorable to the claimant. So basically what you have is you've got a situation where you've got two ends of the spectrum. The BVA has to walk between those two and explain by looking at all the evidence, analyzing its credibility and its probative value, explaining why something does or does not reasonably raise a claim. Now, as an aside, the law is a little bit confused by the fact that in March of 2015, the VA required veterans to use a form to informally claim benefits. So in my opinion, we're adding a layer of confusion, I guess. There's going to, I think, necessarily have to be a different analysis for post-2015 claims where the required informal claim form was filed, or maybe wasn't filed, and pre-2015 claims where no form existed. So my law firm has argued and won two cases in the last year that deal with the issue of reasonably encompassed claims. Those cases are linked up in the show notes. You can see the decisions in those cases, and you can go through the docket and read our briefs to understand a little bit more about how we see the law of reasonably encompassed claims. We're also currently appealing at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, one of the very issues that I thought that the Veterans Court was going to get into in this case, and that was whether specific or general intent is sufficient in determining whether or not a prior claim for benefits reasonably encompassed a condition that remained open and pending until a later grant of those benefits. Either way, if the BVA denies your appeal seeking an earlier effective date, you've got a belief that the earlier claim for benefits reasonably encompassed a recent grant of service connection, give us a call. Contact the law firm of Attic Steel. We're going to review that BVA decision for you to see if you have a BVA error that's appealable to the CAVC. So, that behind us, let's take a look at the BVA decision and talk about the facts that are relevant to the appeal and specifically to the oral argument. In March of 1996, the veteran filed an application for VA disability. Filed his application for VA compensation. He stated he was requesting service connection for disabilities that occurred during service, and he used that word, including right leg numbness, tingling, hearing loss, left knee injury, back injury from a parachute jump, right middle finger, and I believe index finger injury as well. A few months later, the VA granted service connection for a variety of conditions related to those claims, some that were specifically listed on that form and others that were not. In 2009, the veteran sought treatment for a mental health condition, and in September of that year of 2009, he filed using the informal claim form for post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Ultimately, the VA granted him service connection for major depressive disorder and rated him 70% with that effective date of September 2009. He appealed seeking an earlier effective date, and the BVA found that September 2009 was the earliest possible claim for benefits for the mental health condition, and there was no earlier expression of intent to seek benefits for a mental health condition. The veteran's argument is fairly straightforward. In his March 96 claim, he stated he was requesting service connection for disabilities occurring during active duty service. Those are his words from the form. During his active military service, he was diagnosed with and frequently treated for a chronic mental disability. Therefore, his argument is that because his 1996 claim broadly sought benefits for service-connected conditions, and because there was evidence in the record of the veteran's in-service mental health condition, the VA should have reasonably construed his claim to include the mental health condition. Accordingly, the veteran's 1996 claim for service connection of his mental health condition has been open and pending since March 96 and should therefore serve as the effective date for his 2009 grant of service connection for major depressive disorder. Now, an aside here, it's this paradigm for which the court uses the Reese's peanut butter cup metaphor, essentially asking whether blending chocolate, which I guess is the claim form, with peanut butter, which I guess are the service records showing treatment of a condition in service, really makes that Reese's peanut butter cup or the informal claim. I think I got that right. Maybe the chocolate was one thing and the peanut butter was something else. Problem with me is that food metaphors, particularly those involving sugar or candy, they make me hungry and distract me, and I get easily confused. So if you're going up against me in any kind of oral argument, you know, whip out at Baby Ruth bar and I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to throw the whole case. It's over. Anyway, Secretary's argument, equally straightforward. The veteran's 1996 claim did not demonstrate an intent to seek compensation for a mental health condition. The Secretary focuses on the intent element of the claim, and their argument is that the Brokowski case, which I talked about above, requires the veteran to show specific intent to seek specific compensation for a specific condition. The court's statement of the issue. I'm going to read it right from the supplemental oral argument order. Issue 1. Whether a general statement of intent to seek benefits for all service-connected disabilities is sufficient under Brokowski to constitute an informal claim. And 2. If it is, whether the statement of intent must be accompanied by the submission of pertinent medical records, or may the informal claim be made without the submission of records when the records are already in VA's possession or soon will be. Now, I want to make a quick note about the arguments that you're about to hear. You're going to hear extensive discussion in these arguments about how the appellant's counsel at argument framed the issue versus how appellant's counsel on the briefs framed the issue. Now, they're different attorneys. I'm going to refrain from any commentary on this point until I've had a chance to more fully understand the court's concerns, if in fact they're discussed in the court's opinion. For now, all I'm going to say is this. One of the first principles of my law firm is that we work the cases we are capable of working. And I believe that framing issues, briefing issues, and orally arguing issues with a consistent theme or within a consistent framework is the essential core function of the essential work of an appellate attorney. These skills take years to practice. They take years to hone, refine, and then employ in an appeal. If you're an administrative practice attorney, if you work before the regional offices and the boards, please consider, strongly consider hiring an appellate attorney to handle the entirety of your appeal of an adverse BVA decision to the Veterans Court. You put yourself and your client, in my personal opinion, at a disadvantage if your arguments do not fit a consistent and, frankly, a narrow theme throughout the brief and argument. Now, before we go over to the oral argument recording from the Veterans Court, let me introduce you to the panel and the voices that you're going to hear. The first judge you're going to hear is Chief Judge Robert N. Davis. The female judge, the female voice that you will hear is Judge Mary J. Sholin, who, as a side note, is the author of Brokowski. And Judge Michael P. Allen is the third judge on the panel. Appellant's counsel on the briefs, appellant's attorney was John Cameron. At oral argument is Ken Carpenter of Carpenter Chartered. The VA Office of General Counsel attorney is Nathan P. Kirshner, and he is the attorney on briefs and at argument. You can find links to the parties' briefs, their opening response and reply brief, as well as the court's statement of the issues, and a copy of the BVA decision on the court's docket. And you can also find links to that in the show notes and on the VA Form 21 blog. This BVA decision was issued in April 29th, 2016. The BVA hearing officer was Michael Lane, and the claim arises out of the Montgomery, Alabama VA regional office. So I'm going to turn you over to the oral arguments here. Just so you know, there's going to be a change in audio quality, and so I want you just to have your hand on that volume dial. Sometimes it's going to get loud, sometimes it's going to get quiet. But I want you to be ready to make that adjustment. So if you have any questions about what you hear or anything in the argument, or you have any questions about the cases discussed or anything, shoot me an email at vetlaw@addigsteel.com. Take care. Enjoy the arguments.
All right. Oye, oye, oye. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All order of business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. That's the United States and this honorable court. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Davis, to my right is Judge Sholin, and to my left is Judge Allen. We're here today in the matter of Sellers against Wilkie, docket number 162993, to discuss what is generally sufficient under these facts to constitute an informal claim for benefits, and did the Board err in denying an earlier effective date. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Please call me, Mr. Carpenter, for
Welcome. Good to see you both. Welcome. Good to see you both. Are the parties ready to proceed? Yes. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please, Your
Honor. 10 minutes. Okay, Mr. Carpenter, you may proceed.
Kenneth Carpenter, appearing on behalf of Mr. Robert Sellers. The answer to the court's inquiry as to whether or not a general statement of intent to seek benefits for all service-connected disabilities is sufficient under this court's decision in Brokowski has to be a qualified response. It is sufficient only when there is additional evidence in the record that was either submitted as part of the original application, part of the case development by the VA, or by submission by the veteran to support a reasonably raised claim.
Mr. Carpenter, should the veteran not be able to request specifically the benefit? Or shouldn't the veteran request the benefit?
I do not believe that there is any specific responsibility on the part of the veteran to make a specific request. And if this were the only request, that does, I believe, present some difficulty. But I think ultimately, particularly on this record, we have a situation in which evidence was available, first through service treatment records, and secondly on another claim through a VA examination that reasonably raised both of those claims.
But doesn't the veteran have to indicate an intent to seek the benefit?
He does it in informal claim, Your Honor, and that is not a provision that any longer exists in the law. The provisions of 3.155 for informal claims was revised by the Secretary, and therefore we do not have an informal claim.
But in 96 we did.
In 96 we did.
Right.
But I don't believe that informal claim is the proper
Well, you think this should be an incomplete claim?
Beg your pardon?
Incomplete?
No, I believe it should be a reasonably raised claim. Mr. Sellers, in this case, in addition to his general statement, made several very specific statements, including the fact that he had a hearing disability as a result of being in service. He did not make mention of any type of psychiatric disability. However, we believe that under the reasonably raised claim analysis, which we believe is the appropriate analysis in this case, that when you combine evidence of a reasonably raised claim with such a general statement, that that then becomes sufficient to require the VA to adjudicate. And I believe that that is the issue in this case, not whether there was or was not an informal claim.
But whether there was a reasonably raised claim.
Whether there was a reasonably raised claim.
Was this raised in the briefing, Mr. Carpenter?
Not in those terms, Your Honor. What was raised by the author of the briefing was that the claim was pending. And that was the terminology that was used by appellant's counsel in the written brief. And that these the evidence that was available in the record at the time of the 1996 claim constituted a pending claim, first for a mental disability and secondly for tinnitus.
So why should we entertain your argument now that it's a reasonably raised pending claim as opposed to a informal or incomplete application pending claim?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Sellers is merely responding to what this court asked us to respond to, which is the, what's the right word, parameters, if you will, of this court's decision in Brokowski, particularly as they relate to the type of general statement that was made in Mr. Sellers' application.
And in Brokowski, was what kind of claim did Mr. Brokowski assert that he had raised?
Peripheral neuropathy, Your Honor?
No, I mean, was it a reasonably raised claim? Was it an informal claim? Was it?
Well, I believe, at least as I understand or read the facts in the decision, I'm not really sure it qualifies as either. because there was an application made for benefits. There was an issue raised about his having had treatment and service. I believe it was for depression. And then there was an assertion somehow that there should have been a recognition of peripheral neuropathy. The conclusion of this court in Brokowski is that there simply was an absence in the record of any reference to peripheral neuropathy, either raised by the evidence or made by Mr. Brokowski, that would have described his symptoms either during service or post-service, and that the peripheral neuropathy, there were simply no medical records related to peripheral neuropathy in the record before the court. That is factually distinguishable from what are the facts in this case. The facts in this case are clearly that there are two separate reasonably raised claims. The first reasonably raised claim is for a psychiatric disability, and that is reasonably raised by Mr. Sellers' service department records, which were in fact obtained by the VA as part of their obligation to develop Mr. Sellers' application for benefits. The second claim that was raised not through service department records, or for that matter even anything that Mr. Sellers said, except apparently during the course of a VA examination for hearing loss. And apparently during the course of that examination for the hearing loss, the examiner concluded that Mr. Sellers was exposed to acoustic trauma while on active duty, and that he had tinnitus as a result of that exposure.
So you're not relying on the language in the claim, I'll use for want of a better word, where he talked about other disabilities of record or whatever the exact language was?
Well, to the extent that I'm responding to the court's order, I am, because the court asked whether or not that general statement would be sufficient. And I believe that the general statement is sufficient if it is in fact combined, as in this case, with service department records or evidence from a VA examination. Without that connection, then I believe it is not sufficient. That general statement would simply be inadequate. Because as I read Brokowski stands for the proposition that if there's nothing in the record, you cannot impose a burden on the VA to adjudicate something that is not reasonably raised.
But under your current reasonably raised argument, I'm sorry, Judge Allen, if I could just finish this, the veteran would not have been required to even make that statement in the claim. It would just be raised through the record.
I believe that that's the logical extension of what I'm saying, Your Honor. I hadn't really thought it through that way, but yes, I think that would be true, that if he made an application and didn't specify, as was specified here, that he was seeking all service-connected disabilities, then I think a simple application that omitted any reference to either a psychiatric disability or to tinnitus would be sufficient under the facts of this case, where there are service department records that raise the psychiatric disability and a VA examination which raises the tinnitus claim.
Thank you, sir.
So let's take the two claims separately for a second. So just with the psychiatric claim, are you giving up this argument that I'm now going to lay out, which is how I had understood this coming in here? We have a application for benefits that says, in addition to some specific things, a request for service connection for disabilities, quote, occurring during active duty service. Standing alone, not enough. This is my argument. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it's combined with the fact that you get the service treatment records before that application is adjudicated, and those service treatment records show in-service diagnosis and treatment for a mental condition.
Correct.
Now, I don't know whether it matters whether we call that a reasonably raised theory or an informal claim. I don't know if that's a difference, but are you giving up that argument, which is what I had understood the argument to be?
No, Your Honor, I'm not giving it up. I think that that argument is, as I indicated to Judge Scholin, the argument that was raised in the briefs, that this becomes a pending claim because of what happened during the course of the VA's development of this claim, but prior to its decision to adjudicate. And when it adjudicated, it frankly left two claims behind.
Well, we have the psychiatric claim. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, though, where I'm just saying right now I have to think about it, but it doesn't strike me that the reasonably raised versus informal claim distinction makes much of a difference in that context. But for the tinnitus claim, it would, right? Because he wasn't treated during active duty service for that, right?
No, Your Honor, but
Or you mean yes, right? He wasn't treated.
Excuse me.
Right.
You are correct. He was not treated during service for tinnitus. However, treatment during service is not required when there is evidence of exposure to acoustic trauma and a later resulting disability that is diagnosed by a competent professional that relates that to the exposure to the acoustic trauma.
I'm with you on that. I'm saying that if we're treating the psych disorder as an informal claim or reasonably raised claim, I'm saying that there might not be all that much difference here because that disability did occur during active duty service and he was treated and you've got all of these records, right? But I'm not sure that the same logic applies for the hearing issue.
Well, let me suggest that it is equally important in both because the trigger, if you will, is the fact that there is later evidence during the adjudicatory process that reasonably raises the claim. I do not believe, as Judge Davis and I were talking in the very beginning of this argument, that it is incumbent upon the veteran, following this court's analysis in Clemens, that you identify with specificity. Now, what I believe that this unsophisticated veteran attempted to do in 1996 was simply to cover all of his bases, as it were, by throwing in this kitchen sink description of any service-connected disability resulting from service.
Well, how do you reconcile the McPhee kind of medical records are not enough line of cases with this, for example, in the case of tinnitus, raising?
Because in this fact set, Your Honor, we are in adjudication. In McPhee, it was trying to initiate an adjudication based upon those records using the VA regulation, the 3.157B, to initiate an adjudication. Here, there is an ongoing adjudication which, if you will, is omnibus. It covers everything, as is characterized in this general statement, to which the veteran should be entitled to benefits. One of the issues raised in the briefs is the VA's obligation to maximize benefits. And one of those ways of maximizing benefits is to recognize, in the context of the tinnitus claim, that during the course of an examination, that a service-connected disability is clearly identified and is related to service, which then meets all of the qualifications for awarding that benefit, which then would maximize the veteran's benefit, and the VA should not be permitted to simply walk away from evidence which is favorable to the veteran.
So even if the veteran didn't have that magic language in his application, if the service records demonstrated diagnoses of various conditions, VA would have an obligation to adjudicate claims for all those conditions?
Any condition that is reasonably raised in the record to have been related to an injury, a disease, or event in service.
Would to have related to would then somebody have to demonstrate evidence of a current disability before it somehow magically transforms into a reasonably raised claim? Or
no.
Does a mere existence of injury or disease in service?
I would suggest that in the context of the psychiatric claim, that it is sufficient that it merely demonstrate that there was a diagnosed condition, but it could also be symptoms and manifestations of a condition that occurred during service, which then prompts the VA's duty to assist to develop additional evidence vis-a-vis a necessary medical opinion to determine whether there is or isn't a current disability, similar to the disability that may have been inferred as having occurred while on active duty, and that that current disability is relatable to what is demonstrated in the service records.
Well, in virtually every case, assuming the records are available, there's going to be service records available in claim.
Yes.
So how does this scenario that you lay out not result in the unguided safari that Brokowski feared?
Well, I think in both of the factual circumstances in this case, there isn't anything unguided. In other words, you have multiple disabilities identified: chronic anxiety, chronic insomnia, moderate depression, dysthymia, multiple somatic dysfunctional reactions. I've never really heard that one before. But clearly that identifies some concrete evidence of a in-service psychiatric disease that was going on. So there's no uncharted safari here, because the VA has medical records that lead in a very specific direction. And then, vis-a-vis the VA's duty to assist, there are two questions that have to be answered vis-a-vis a medical examination. Is there or isn't there a current disability of a psychiatric nature, and is it or isn't it, at least as likely as not, related to what was shown in service?
And how do we know the duty to assist applies?
I'm sorry?
How do we know the duty to assist would apply in this scenario? Because, I mean, clearly for a situation after the VCAA, it would, under your theory. But what about in 1996?
I don't think there was, I would suggest that the service records would have then constituted a well-grounded claim of evidence of an injury in service, psychiatric injury.
So, because what I'm getting at is precisely that. It's sort of a thicket for this, in a sense. But if we wanted to go down the duty to assist route, would we have to remand to the board to make an initial determination as to whether or not the claims, as I'm going to use air quotes for that, the claims were well grounded, or can the court make that determination initially itself?
Oh, now you're going to make me try to recall the well groundedness case law. I don't believe, as I recall, the well groundedness case law, that it would be appropriate for this court to make that decision in the first instance in terms of well-groundedness. Please let me clarify. I do think that the appropriate remedy in this case is to remand with instructions to the board to direct the regional office to adjudicate both of these reasonably raised claims, which would then implicate the duty to assist, because the adjudication is taking place now. The adjudication should have taken place in 1995, but it didn't. The adjudication has to be ordered by this court to be undertaken. And then it would be undertaken under the laws as they exist now.
Right, but if the error in 1996 by the VA is predicated on a problem with the duty to assist then.
No, it is not, Your Honor. The error is predicated on the failure to recognize a reasonably raised claim by the evidence that was of record. In the context of the psychiatric condition, the evidence of the service records. In the context of the tinnitus claim, the evidence from the VA examination. That's the error of law. The question that was raised in this appeal was whether or not the effective date for the grant of ultimately both of those conditions should go further back. It cannot go further back until there's an adjudication.
If we were, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Mr. Carpenter, I understand your argument, and quite frankly, I've prepared in a way, and maybe I went down the wrong track here on the informal claim and all that. And as I read through the brief, I guess my point is the brief doesn't make your argument here that clear to me. Could you add 10 minutes, please? I have a number of questions. I think my colleagues do also. So when I look through the brief, okay, and I understand you didn't write it, there is a lot of reference about the informal claim argument and the issue by the board. And at the end of this brief, there certainly is, I'm looking at pages 26, 27, and forward.
I'm sorry, 26, Your Honor?
Yes, page 26 of the brief. D.
Ah, yes.
Where you get into, or the counsel gets into the description of the board's failure to recognize the claim. So, granted, there's no specific reference in your brief or counsel's brief to informal claim. And also noticeably absent is an argument about this claim being reasonably raised, although it is referred to as a pending claim. I'm just making a point that this is a bit misleading, I think. And it would be helpful in the future to, clarify.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I was guided by the court's order.
Right.
I frankly, although I obviously read the briefs of both parties, I felt like this court, for the purpose of this argument, had directed the parties to talk about this case in the context of Brokowski and whether Brokowski does or doesn't, if you will, control and preclude this case from...
Understood. But in Brokowski, there's a whole host of discussion on informal claims, right? And also, in this litigation, there is, in the informal claim submission in 2009, that's an informal claim. That's a record at, I'll get the record site here, 2647. I mean, you're not suggesting that that's not an informal claim submission, a telephone call from the appellant to the VA. And that adds the PTSD component to this in 2009, right? But my point is that the language, not only that, but, you know, as the question was phrased in Brokowski, there's also, when you look at the record at 2684, the 96 claim, which deals with a whole host of physical issues, no mention of a mental issue other than that last reference, which could relate back to the physical issues. It's not clear to me that that necessarily identifies any mental issue either. But I think...
But it seems to me, Your Honor, with all due respect, that drifts away from this court's obligation to determine whether or not this case was correctly decided. What the board said was is that there was no claim for either of these conditions. There was a claim that was reasonably raised by the evidence, which was characterized in the briefing as a pending claim for each of those conditions. In terms of this court's decision in Brokowski, I recognize that there was multiple references to informal claim, but the way in which the question is framed is whether or not the general statement of intent is sufficient under Brokowski to constitute an informal claim. My response is no, because it's not an informal claim.
But that's, well, you didn't say that in the brief. I'm sorry. That was not stated at all in the brief.
No, but what was stated in the brief was is that there was a pending claim, Your Honor.
Right.
And that's the question of law that's before this court. Is there or isn't there something that raises the claim, whether we use the vehicle of an informal claim or the analysis of reasonably raised claim? The legal question is there, are there or are there not pending claims for a psychiatric condition from the 1996 application and a pending claim for tinnitus from that same application? These flow from, as I understood the court's question, from the general statement. And I'm saying to you that yes, they do, but they must be combined with evidence that's in the record. And that's the analysis that this court needs to make, is the evidence in the record sufficient to cause this court to depart from the holding in Brokowski on a basis that was not considered in Brokowski? I don't see how Brokowski applies to this case, particularly if you limit Brokowski to an informal claim. An informal claim, as I understand it under the prior statute or regulation 3.155, is a writing that expresses an intent for a benefit. That, to me, is separate and apart from the writing that you do on a VA form. There was a clear form in March of 1996 that was completed, and it spoke in part to specific conditions, including hearing loss, and in part to a more broader, more general statement. The question, as I understood it from this court, was, is that general statement sufficient?
Well, I think your point and your argument here today is a good one with respect to the distinction between reasonably raised and informal, and it makes a difference. You're absolutely correct.
But don't they both, at the end of the day, whether you use the informal claim or the reasonably raised, determine the question of whether there's a pending claim? Because if there's not a pending claim, then Mr. Sellers cannot prevail. The only way he can prevail in this case is to demonstrate that there were two claims pending at the time in which the VA assigned the effective
date. Whether or not they were reasonably raised or informal, I agree.
Correct.
So in terms of the tonight's claim, though, it doesn't appear that the board made a decision on that claim. And I was looking back, and the only argument about this in the brief is that the board failed to refer the claim to a regional office for adjudication. But I'm not sure that that's dealt with in the board decision here. I'm not sure that there's jurisdiction in that for that claim, whether we call it reasonably raised or something else. And you don't have to answer now, but you can answer when you come back up on rebuttal, and that's fine. But that is a distinction for me.
No, you're correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I did not.
Oh, no, you can
that.
Stop him saying that. That's perfect.
No. I missed that. I'm looking at the issues here. I would have sworn there was one related to hearing, but there is not one that is identified on the board's decision. So know that they did not, and as a result, I think you're probably correct to Mr. Sellers' misfortune. But I do think, I'm trying to remember the name of the case, remember Judge Lance wrote it, that says that there is a way if you think there's a pending claim.
DiCarlo?
DiCarlo, yes, DiCarlo, to compel that. So he does have a remedy.
It's just not here.
It's just not here. Just
so
not
then let me just follow up one thing on Chief Judge Davis's question. Now that we've gotten that claim off the table in my head for a moment, and we're back to the psychiatric claim, is there a meaningful difference in your view about whether one looks at that claim as reasonably raised by the evidence in the record on the one hand, or as an informal claim because of the statement on the application combined with the service treatment records. Is there some meaningful difference there?
I think there is meaningful difference because the regulation that existed in 1996, as this court has interpreted that regulation in its case law, had a very specific expectation, meaning that you had to clearly articulate your intent to apply for a benefit.
So,
and that general statement is not a clearly articulated intent.
Okay, I wanna be really clear on this one point, so I leave the bench understanding. I understand what you just said legally and factually. I got that. But the argument based on the informal claim, as the Chief Judge was saying, that was the one in the brief. And again, I understand you didn't write the brief, so right, it's a little bit of a mismatch. But that was the one in the brief. It seems like you're saying now something that is, as to that issue, much more akin to the Secretary's argument, which is that statement not good enough, and therefore you're pivoting to the reasonably raised point. But I want to be clear as to whether you actually are giving up the argument that the statement that was made on the application combined with the service treatment records obtained before adjudication was sufficient to establish an informal claim, or are you sticking with that too?
I am sticking with that. That was what was presented in the brief. I did not understand the brief to say that it was an informal claim. I understood the brief to me to describe it as a pending claim. I don't recall the author of the brief using that phraseology. Now I may be misremembering, but and to me that's an important distinction here, because what was presented in the brief was whether or not the board did or did not err in determining the effective date for the psychiatric disability, which they granted, which I think they granted as of 2009.
So I need to make sure that I'm clear.
Are you saying that
there is the statement in the application,
in the
96, is insufficient, or are you saying that it would be sufficient coupled with the SMRs to also constitute an informal claim?
I'm saying the latter without the reference to informal claim. It just doesn't seem to me that's what was put forth in the brief, that creates a pending claim, however you characterize it, when you combine that statement with the service treatment records. And what I am saying is that the general statement alone cannot support it. It must be combined with something else.
Now,
and
in the
indisputable facts in this case, it is combined. I'm sorry.
I hate to quibble, but when the Secretary in his brief replying to the primary brief of the appellant, mm-hmm. cited Brokowski, talked about how this would fail under Brokowski. Mm-hmm. The reply brief talks about Brokowski and says, unlike Brokowski, or this would satisfy Brokowski, because it's not just a generalized statement, it's a generalized statement plus records.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that seems an implicit statement that they are arguing that it's an informal claim plus records under Brokowski, not reasonably raised, not some other characterization. They don't cite to any regulation that talks about reasonably raised claims I'm aware of. So I'm just having a hard time accepting your pivot as a response to this court's be prepared to discuss order and not an expansion or abandonment of an original argument.
Well, Your Honor, the reply brief attempts to respond to the argument that the effect of Brokowski is to preclude the result sought by the appellant.
Right, but they didn't argue that Brokowski isn't even applicable in this context because it's a reasonably raised claim, not an informal claim. Did they?
No, they did not, Your Honor. The question, however, is in my mind as counsel, I feel constrained to represent to this court that this constitutes an informal claim because I read the informal claim as being defined by 3.155.
But is this fair to opposing counsel who prepared under perhaps a different construct?
Well, I believe it is, Your Honor, because I'm simply expressing the appellant's response to the court's order in the context of whether it is or isn't sufficient under Brokowski. And it is sufficient under Brokowski with the qualification that it is combined with. And that's what was said in the reply brief. So long as it is combined with. Now, if this court feels that informal claim is the correct characterization, then this court is obviously free to ignore everything I've said about reasonably raised claims. But you cannot ignore that what was said in the reply brief is that Brokowski applies, is differentiated because in this case it is a general statement plus. And that general statement plus either fits under the parameters of Brokowski or it does not. My duty of candor to the court compels me to tell this court that it can't be an informal claim because there was no separate writing other than in the application. So you can't use the application, which is a formal claim, to somehow transcend into an informal claim. And this court, from the beginning, has struggled with the need for precision in what is being described. And this, to me, is another example of where we need to be more precise in our description of what constitutes or creates a pending claim.
So I've asked this before, and I thought I got it, but it slipped out of my grasp. So, you know, I'll put my cards on the table for the way I was thinking about this when I came in, right, which is that this case was different than Brokowski because of the statement on the application plus the existence of the service treatment records, and that that would have been sufficient to constitute an informal claim. That was my tentative position, which I would have told the secretary when he got up there and said, why am I wrong? Mm-hmm. But I think you've just told me why I'm wrong, because you say an informal claim cannot be part of the formal claim. And so that seems like you actually are giving up the argument that this is an informal claim. And I may just be missing this.
Okay. To the extent that the court is saying I am giving it up, I don't believe that it is appropriate for me to contradict the brief. The brief staked out a position. I am responding to the question that was presented, and I believe that I have an obligation to tell the court that the characterization as an informal claim is imprecise and inaccurate, that that's not what was in the record in this case. And therefore, the reliance upon Brokowski is not valid, but it's not valid because Brokowski didn't have the combination. There was the combination. So then it becomes simply a matter of, is the correct characterization informal claim or is the correct characterization reasonably raised? That's a judgment that this panel has to make.
Mr. Carpenter, I could not agree with you more that your obligation to tell the court as early as you can, reliance on Brokowski perhaps not appropriate in this factual context, and that the language needs to be more precise. My only question is, why didn't you do that in the reply brief or with some supplemental pleading to say this is not an informal claim, this is a reasonably raised claim? All the things you just said, you could have told us that in the papers, right? And that would have been earlier notice of where you were going today.
Well, in fairness, Your Honor, I'm different counsel than the counsel who wrote the brief. And the counsel who wrote the brief obviously got this court's order to call to panel and to argument and looked at his briefing and then asked if I would do the argument. Anytime any other counsel comes, or a different counsel comes, they come with their own perspective. However, in this case, the response, as Judge Scholin correctly pointed out, to Burkowski was raised by the government. The government was the one that initiated the discussion of Burkowski. Burkowski wasn't offered by the appellant in his opening brief as the basis for that entitlement. He was simply responding to and offered an argument that said that it must be in combination, and then presupposing that this court's decision in Burkowski correctly characterized it as an informal claim, followed that logic.
I understand. But perhaps we might avoid this confusion in the future in a way that you have control over.
If I were the author of the briefs in this case, they would have been written differently. But that's just a function.
Could you not have submitted a supplemental statement or something indicating how you were going in this in response to our supplemental order? I think the answer to that is yes.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I confess it did not occur to me because, quite frankly, I thought, as I read this, that that's where this court was going with this. I was not as focused on the informal claim part as I was focused on the combination part. So quite frankly, in my view, I had to understand how these dots connected, and the only way the dots could ultimately connect to make it a pending claim is that it was a reasonably raised claim by these service records. And to the extent that I have gone awry once again, I apologize.
No, I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kirshner, I added 22 minutes to appellant's time. If you need it, you may have that.
Thank you, Robert.
I'm sure you are really glad for that.
May it please the Court, Nathan Kirshner representing the Secretary. The Secretary urges the Court to affirm the March 29, 2016 board decision that denied an effective date prior to September 18, 2009 for service connection for major depressive disorder and also an increased rating over 70% for that claim. Your Honors, in response to the Court's order, generally a sympathetic reading is not a mind reading or prognostication, and it is not unguided research. A general statement of intent to seek benefits, as was found in box 40 of the March 1996 claim form, for all service-connected disabilities is not sufficient to constitute an informal claim under Burkowski. Such a statement.
So, Mr. Kirshner, section 1 of the order clearly indicates that the court is interested in whether or not that statement constitutes an informal claim.
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
So you agree with that?
We agree with that, and pursuant
to...
It's right there, Your Honor. It says informal claim in the order.
Apparently, appellant's counsel has the same order, I assume. Right. Okay. Just want to make the point.
So I'm sorry. You agree that it's an informal... I mean, that if it were any kind of claim, it would be an informal claim?
Yes, Your Honor. We're not prepared to discuss the issue of a reasonably raised claim at
Why
this
not?
Point because that was We had no notice of it. This is the first time we're hearing about that description of the issue or that characterization.
You didn't get that from appellant's brief?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. But I know this isn't something you potentially prepared for, but do you have any statement at this time about whether a person can raise an informal claim on a formal application?
We have no statement on that, Your Honor. I think that in this instance, from the briefing, it appears what appellant has attempted to do is to assert that even though the formal claim is very clear about the issues that he's seeking, the general statement in Box 40 somehow constitutes a separate informal claim on that claims form. So that's what we're prepared to discuss.
And it seemed to me, and I mean, I treading on thin ice because Judge Sholin is on the panel here and she wrote Berkowski, but it seemed to me that Berkowski left open the question of whether or not a general statement on an application combined with something else could together sort of make the Reese's peanut butter cup, right? Two tastes, they taste great together, right? I don't think Berkowski actually decided that. What's your view about, first of all, did Berkowski answer that question? And it just Berkowski didn't make it that far, Mr. Berkowski. And if it didn't, what's the Secretary's position about whether those things can combine to equal an informal claim?
Your Honor, Berkowski, I think, did answer the question. And it seems like the question is how wide open the door is for this type of thing. What Berkowski said was that the court can't ignore a general request for benefits, a general statement requesting benefits, but that inability to ignore that statement must be coupled with, and this is the quote from Berkowski, coupled with the submission of particular medical records. And so here, it's not enough just to have the statement come into the record on its own. It has to have the records that accompany it. This goes to the second part of the order. And those records should be particular. It should be, in essence, enough to identify the disability that appellant's making the claim for.
So if these records weren't, so what is it about these records that then wouldn't, let's assume that the statement you just read is the actual holding, and right? So why wouldn't these records qualify as the sufficient plus? I mean, they were obtained, now they weren't submitted with, but they were obtained as part of the adjudication of that application, and they specifically do deal with the diagnosis and treatment for psychiatric conditions.
And I think that's where we get into Berkowski and the language in Berkowski being important, because what Berkowski found was that the claim must be coupled with the submission of the particular records. So if a veteran were to go through their service medical records, look at them, find treatment records, you know, relating to two or three disabilities, write on a piece of paper, I would like service connection for these disabilities from service, general statement, and submit the 10 pages of records that show three different disabilities, that seems like because of that submission of those particular records, it would be able to go through that Berkowski door. This, instead, just saying randomly there's something in my records, disabilities and service, essentially everything, it opens the door, I think, wider than Berkowski allows, and it asks for the unguided safari that they cautioned against.
So the problem then, in your view, and tell me if I'm wrong, okay, the problem isn't so much content of the records. The problem is submission.
I think so, Your Honor, because the content and submission both play a part. But what the question Berkowski was trying to answer was, what is enough in a submission from an appellant to identify the benefits sought?
In terms
of the particular benefit.
Right. But it seems like the content of these records, right, wouldn't be a problem to you had they been pulled out and submitted by Mr. Sellers with his 1996 application, right? In other words, Berkowski's concerned with content and not going on the unguided safari.
Correct.
Right. So the content is okay here.
So if it was his whole service records, you mean?
Or I'm getting to that next, okay. Right? So because first, right, so whatever is in the record is good enough for you to actually say, wow, it's a psychiatric diagnosis here, right?
Well, the records do show he was treated for a psychiatric disability in service, yes,
sir. Right. And so, and his request in box 40 says disabilities occurring during active duty service. So that matches. So it seems to me it has to be something about the submission, which could be the timing of submission, which is the way I framed it initially, or Judge Schoen's question, the amount of record. In other words, it's not enough to just say in my records, it has to be these pages or something like that. Is that right?
I mean, I think both timing and information in the record has to be considered here. These records were developed, it seems, along with this claim, but there hasn't been a showing that they were actually in the record at the time the claim was made, and I think that's why.
But does that matter? I mean, would it really make a difference if they were submitted on the same day or the application came in on day one and then VA was amazingly efficient and got the records on day two that showed this? I mean, that would be that seems like a really hyper-technical basis on which to draw the distinction.
I think the important thing, or the distinction there that can be important, is that when you're looking at these records, in conjunction with a general statement seeking benefits, you're trying to determine the intent of the veteran to say, these are the benefits I am seeking entitlement for. And it's that statement of intent that makes the informal claim that triggers the rest of the development of going to get exams, adjudication, etc. So without having that, all those pieces of the Reese's peanut butter cup all together at the same time, you don't know that you're going to be eating a Reese's peanut butter cup. Instead, you have peanut butter and chocolate. And if you get peanut butter on Monday and chocolate on Tuesday and no direction that you're supposed to make a Reese's peanut butter cup, then that's, to go back to what we're talking about, not sufficient to be an informal claim.
I understand what you're saying, but I think the paragraph before, the paragraph you quoted in Berkowski, contemplated that potentially evidence could be submitted at the time that the claimant files a claim or during the claim's development. So now I don't remember why we did that, but we said that. And so in theory, Berkowski was hypothesizing that intent didn't happen only at the time of filing.
But the intent could come later.
Yeah. So how do you respond to that?
Nevertheless, Your Honor, within Berkowski, there's the unguided safari issue. It's I think burdensome to, and overly burdensome, as Berkowski found, to have the agency undertake an unguided safari to determine that intent. I mean, perhaps intent could come in later in the record, but as long as it is nonspecific, as the content is nonspecific, that's a harder.
So it gets back to sort of more the volume than the timing. So if
specificity as well, yes.
Yeah. So if in his service records he only ever had one particular treatment and one diagnosis, maybe that could be enough. Instead of, like, I had a cold, I sprained an ankle, I had psychiatric problems, I don't know all that Mr. Sellers has, I'm just kind of making stuff up. So if they went to sick call one time, they had this diagnosis, the service records came in 3 months later, could that be enough?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it goes back to the submission of particular records. I think there has to be something that comes in together that shows a very specific intent. I mean, here we have an appellant who, at the time of the filing of the 1996 claim, was very sophisticated. If you look at box 17 which is analogous to the box 25 referred to in Rokowski, he lists the natures of the disabilities for which you are claiming benefits. He lists them. He lists the branch of service he was in. He lists the date they happened. And then when you look at box 40, the general statement, disabilities occurring during active service, that seems to be just a repetition of the preprinted text in box 12, where he again lists the same very specific disabilities. So he wrote that in there, but also in box 40, there are, you know, further remarks. It's the remarks box, and it says, if you don't have enough space, please attach more pages and describe in your remarks which boxes you're referring to. If he wanted to list more issues, like a psychiatric issue, it certainly appears that he would have and could have done so. Here the question is whether the board, the board's finding as to whether there was anything that constituted an informal claim before 2009. The board found it was not. That finding is based on essentially reasonableness, and then the board's finding has to be reviewed for clear error. So well, given everything, I think it's very difficult to get to the point where the board's decision is clearly erroneous on this.
In 1996, the VA granted service connection for a fracture of the tip of the appellant's toe. However, his broken toe is not mentioned in the application form. I'm guessing VA saw mention of this in his service records and ultimately granted him service connection. It doesn't appear anywhere on the claim form. So what was VA's basis for being able to grant that benefit?
Your Honor, I'm not sure about the toe. I don't have that in front of me. But
and they basically did the same thing with hearing loss when they granted that back in 1971. It wasn't listed as an issue on the rating decision. The rating decision stated it was adjudicating an original claim in which the service connection for right inguinal hernia and laceration of the right hand, hearing loss wasn't mentioned, but it was service connected. So, you know, to Mr. Carpenter's point, it looks like VA did look through his service records in two instances and find some sort of claim, whatever you want to call it, in that they were able to grant it. And this isn't the only time VA's. I've seen VA, you know, grant benefits that veterans haven't specifically asserted on a claims form. What's their authority for doing that?
Another point, Your Honor, from the ratings decision in this case, I believe when he requested service connection for numbness in his leg, when it was later granted in the rating decision, that was granted not as a separate claim, but it was granted as part of his back claim, and he was rated under IBDS.
Right, and that's sort of a Clemens kind of a
Situation. Sort of a Clemens kind of situation. And so I think really it comes back to...
But he didn't mention toe.
The intent, Your Honor. I don't know. Perhaps the adjudicator took the statement relating to his leg as, let's look at anything involving the leg, and went from there. But certainly in terms of the psychiatric disability, we don't even have the direction of listing the body part or the symptoms involved. He doesn't say he's sad or he's anxious. He doesn't say, you know, he doesn't mention his psyche. So we just, there's not that same, you know, direction in the claim that there even could have been for the toe, frankly, under mentioning the leg.
So it's not really an issue here, though, of intent, right? It really is an intent to do what that is at issue, right? In other words, I think Judge Sholin used the term specificity, right? There's no question that he intended to apply for benefits for disabilities occurring during active duty service. I mean, he expresses that. So it's not the normal situation where, well, there's a statement about something. We're not sure if you want anything. Right? So it really is, what do you want?
Right. It's the three parts of the test, you know, for the informal claim. It has to be in writing. It has to have an intent. And it has to show, identify the benefits sought.
Right. So it's really the third part that...
And identification, I think, here is what we're focusing on. But at the same time, you know, there sort of has to be the intention to identify that benefit. You know, they all kind of are mixed together like the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. And I think you're right, though, we focus here on the identification, and there is none.
Mr. Kirshner, is there any overlap between the duty to assist and the reference to the service medical records?
Your Honor, I don't think so at this point, because it doesn't appear there was anything that they really failed to do. He clearly identified the disabilities he was seeking benefits for. VA undertook development for those, and they were adjudicated. I think in the case, if it was just a very general statement, I'm seeking benefits with nothing more, VA perhaps would have sent him a letter saying, please clarify. But here, when he evidenced an ability to be so specific on the claim form, I think it's perfectly reasonable for VA to consider that the extent of the claim and proceed with development and adjudication. So I don't think
anything was triggered. As the VA developed, they also developed and found service medical records that dealt with mental depression disorder and other anxiety and depressive medical reports that occurred in service. So was there any obligation on the part of the department then to do something more? Or do you just ignore those records that are in the record?
I mean, I think they're in the record, but I don't think that they need to be looked at until there's found to be some kind of an informal claim for them. It's also worth noting that there is in the record, and I apologize, this was not included in the ROPE. Because this claim form listed so many disabilities, appellant was not just provided with a hearing loss examination in May of 1996, he was also provided with a general medical examination, and that, amongst its findings, in the psychiatric block noted psychiatric and personality normal. So it appears that at the time he wasn't found to have a disability, within 2 months after service.
What was the block number on that?
It was its record at 2681, and it started, I think, at 2677 or 2679. I think 2679.
And is that in the, you said that's not?
It's not in the ROPE, I'm sorry, Your Honor. We didn't think it was going to be taking quite that turn in briefing. So I'm happy to supplement if the court would like.
I'll leave it to the Chief Judge, yeah. But that strikes me as probably something we might want to see.
Right.
But that would, where would that play in, right? So because that report of examination wouldn't go to Mr. Sellers' intent at all, right? Because that couldn't undermine an intent that he would have if we assume he had it.
Well, right? In a way it could, Your Honor, and this goes back to Clemens. Judge Schoen brought up McPhee before, and Clemens discussed McPhee and also Kaluza, and the court noted in Clemens that quite a different result is reached when a claimant requests compensation for a particular diagnosis. This would, I guess, then assume the intent piece was satisfied, but after proper development, the medical evidence revealed no current condition relating to the symptoms suffered. For example, appellant had filed this claim for PTSD, but no current mental condition whatsoever was diagnosed. The claim could have been properly denied at that point for lack of diagnosis of the current condition under Kaluza.
Well, but that would be, we'd have to make a whole bunch of factual assumptions there, right? Because then it would have been, had the VA recognized this as an informal claim because of the service medical and box 40 together, they would have, even after developing that claim, determined that that report of medical examination that you're talking about was sufficient to tip the scales against. There's a lot of moving pieces there, right?
Sure, but the biggest moving piece, or the sort of the catalytic piece, would be for the court to agree with the appellant's argument. If there's not a finding of intent of identification of the benefit sought for a mental disorder, then VA did not even need to start down that road, and it didn't need to start down that road.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kirshner, could I, just for the record, would you supplement the record documents you referred to, the report of examination, right before Judge Allen's question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm assuming that appellants have that, but provide them a copy as well.
Of course, Your Honor. If there's nothing further, Your Honor, the Secretary urges the Court to affirm the Board's decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Several matters I'd like to get to, but I think I want to start with the duty to assist that you raised, Judge Davis. The government has asserted that there is no relationship to the duty to assist in this case, that the duty to assist would not have been prompted based upon the receipt of the Service Department records. That seems to be entirely inconsistent with Congress's off-quoted description of its intent when it enacted the VJRA, in which they said that they expected that the Secretary would continue in his duty to fully develop the record. And it seems to me that that brings in clear focus the difference between the position of the appellant and the position of the VA in this case. The VA seems to believe that under this Court's decision in Brokowski that, there is a specificity requirement that needs to be made. In this case, we are talking about an application that was made by the veteran that said specific disabilities and then in a separate section referred to more general disabilities. That is a clearly expressed intent that he desires compensation for any disability for which he should be service-connected. When the VA received the Service Department records, under the government's assertion, the government would be allowed to ignore those unless the veteran specifically said, those records justify a specific desire on my part to be compensated for my psychiatric disability. That goes way beyond a non-adversarial system. To the contrary, that imposes an adversarial burden on the veteran to be specific, to make a specific assertion, to say that, I can't just generally say that when in combination with records that you obtained from my service records that clearly indicate that during service I had a psychiatric problem. And it seems to me that a psychiatric problem differs from a physical problem because there are lots of reasons with a psychiatric problem that a veteran would be in denial about that and may not wish to make that specific assertion due to embarrassment or whatever. But that in no way diminishes the right of the veteran to have that issue adjudicated. Now, clearly one could argue that the veteran can say, I do not wish to have that. And clearly, I think the VA would have to honor that. But in the Brokowski case at page 12, continuing on to page 13, the Court said specifically, we do not hold that the inclusion of the term all disabilities of record in an application for VA benefits coupled with the submission of a particular medical record can be ignored in determining whether an appellant has sufficiently identified the benefit in which he's seeking. That's what this Court said in Brokowski.
So, but what do we do, because that leads us to, stick with our safari metaphor, that leads us to the elephant in the room, which is that passage you just read seems to suggest precisely what the Secretary's counsel said, which is here's my application and here is my medical record. Right, as opposed to here's my application that says anything occurring during service, and here's my big stack of medical records, and now go through and look, and that may be the place where we have to make the call.
It may well be, Your Honor, but it seems to me that the underlying question is, does what the Secretary described constitute an adversarial proceeding in which the burden is shifted to the veteran to, as it were, raise that flag? Or, in this case, as opposed to the example given by the government, this is not a submission made by the veteran. The veteran didn't submit his service records. The VA obtained those service records. And once they obtained them, Pandora's box was opened. And the question then becomes, in a non-adversarial system, when the veteran makes an expression, as was made here, that he wishes to be service-connected for all of the disabilities to which he's entitled from service, they are on notice of psychiatric records. And that then requires the VA to fully and sympathetically develop the record, which would include obtaining a medical opinion and a nexus opinion.
Well, even the court has said, even in a non-adversarial setting, that the veteran has certain obligations. Like, you know, we've said the duty to assist is not a one-way street. Veteran has to identify things, for example. So it seems to me that the veteran would have some knowledge of what conditions continued to bother them subsequent to service. So when they were in service, they may have gone to seek medical attention for acute conditions, you know, a cold, a muscular sprain, whatever. They have absolutely no ongoing relationship to their life now. Is it really so incongruous that the veteran should be required to assert or at least point VA in the direction of the things that continue to be a problem for them, as opposed to, here's my big stack of stuff, I'll take anything you get. But the veteran who didn't say, and all the service-connected disabilities or anything else of record or whatever spaghetti, I get to use this twice in a row now, spaghetti threw at the wall, that other veteran may not get this VA review of an entire sheaf of records. So is, you know.
I think that's a fair question to raise in the realm of physical disabilities. I do not think that's a fair question to raise in the realm of a psychiatric disability. And I believe this case gives us a pretty good example, because in this case, later, he was service-connected for the major depressive disorder and ultimately service-connected for the post-traumatic stress disorder. So we have a clear indication that eventually this condition was disabling. And by the way, we don't know whether or not it was or wasn't disabling in 1996 because the VA took no action. So what the VA does, what the VA would be permitted to do.
Well, in theory, VA did, according to Mr. Kirshner's undisclosed record document, that he had this medical opinion that said his psychiatric condition was normal.
And he didn't seem to complain about MDD or PTSD during service, as far as we can tell.
Certainly, Your Honors.
Well, he had dysthymia in service. That's depression. So.
But in this case, we're talking about an effective date claim and not talking about how the claim should or should not have been adjudicated, other than to the extent that the receipt of those service records should have triggered an adjudication. That adjudication could have resolved the matter by finding that he didn't have a current disability. That would have been the end of it. The question of law in this case is about, did the VA have a duty to adjudicate or not? Was there sufficient evidence in this record when the service department records, treatment records, were combined with his general statement to impose a duty to adjudicate? And I believe that the record clearly demonstrates that, to the extent that the complaint from Mr. Sellers was the failure of the board to address this pending claim. So in the board's decision, I don't think you're going to find any discussion about all of the things that we have been hypothesizing about, because they simply didn't go down that road. The question in this appeal is whether or not they should have gone down that road based upon the evidence that was in the record at the time in which they were considering the effective date. The error here is about the board's error, even though we have been focused primarily on what was or was not done in 1996. Unless there's further questions from the panel. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you all. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.
Court is in recess.